Welcome to the With Ingram Series of Podcasts. I'm Philip Ingram. This is episode 10, and today I'm talking to a fantastic lady who's recognized as a visionary and transformational strategist. Her name is Lisa Short. Warning, you might actually learn something. Okay, Lisa, welcome to the With Ingram Series of Podcasts. Now, for those that are listening into this, can you do me a favor and tell us all a little bit about you, your background, and where you fit in?
Sure. The easiest way to describe what I do is transformational strategy. And I guess my background is what they used to call being a generalist. So you sort of move, you know, you evolve as your career goes. And I've gone from accounting and financial management to economics, to education, to health, to medicine, to industry, et cetera. And I guess the common theme, though, or the common thread that goes through that is two things. One is frontier technology and the use of technologies and the potentials of technologies, education as a tool, and of course, bringing together ecosystem and design thinking so that we can advance technologies to make businesses better, economies better, people work better together in a harmonious way. So I guess that's in a very, you know, broad nutshell what I do. Now it's a lot of advisory service. It's very tangible in its way. It's always got to be outcome focused, not just talk. And yeah, at the moment,
that's always a better way of doing things. You know, focus on what you're trying to achieve, not what you want, not what you think people should be doing.
Correct. I think it's one of the things I often say is that the consulting model over the last 20, 30 years is fundamentally broken, because it doesn't actually give people tangible tools and hand-holding to actually deploy technologies or to deploy those solutions. All it gives them is information and they still don't know how to do it. So, you know, using education is without a doubt key, but so is technology. Technology is the enabler. Education is the tool that we need to have the information and the knowledge and the wisdom to be able to apply it. So, and of course, in the last couple of years, without a doubt, the potentials of blockchain and frontier technologies using AI, data, Internet of Things and so forth is extremely powerful.
It is. It's interesting. So what got you into this in the first place? And whilst you're UK-based normally, you're not in the UK at the moment, and your accent isn't from the UK. So you know, if you could tell us a little bit about, A, what got you into there, and this accent that you seem to have. I've got one too, but it's funny. It's not the same.
Yeah, well, I don't have an accent at all. I think it's you that's got the accent, actually. You seem to have a very funny accent. But no, my funny accent obviously is Australian, and I'm very proudly of Australian. But one of the reasons I'm not in Australia normally, although I am at the moment, because clearly I can't get back to the UK or to Europe or anywhere else.
Yeah, we've decided we're not letting you out.
No, well, you know, they did let me out and now I can't get back in. So when they get back in, I won't be getting back out again. But look, you know, I popped home again. You know, we are a global world and, you know, I am Australian. I've got family and business interests and so forth here. And I popped home for about 4 to 6 weeks with the intentions of going back via, you know, Africa and America and then back to the UK. And I'm unfortunately going to be here now for about 6 to 9 months. But one of the reasons I'm not is that Australia is a fairly non-innovative country. A lot of people that are innovators and future leaders and thought leaders, you will find gravitate to where the market is, where there's fast-moving innovation, and it's definitely not here. We are a very small market for starters, but we're also very resistant to change and a very young culture. So we have a fairly high resistance to innovation. In terms of business interests, it's very difficult to do business from Australia, being on completely opposite time zones. But so normally I'm based over that side of the world, but it has been a very easy transition for me. It doesn't really matter where I am, the work that I do. You know, I literally now am working all night and all day instead of just all day. So that's really the change, I guess.
Great stuff. And what got into you to this line of work here? What was your background that focused you in on it? Because you've clearly got an awful lot of experience that you can bring to apply.
Yeah. Look, I think it was my generalist background. I started in accounting and financial management, which I think has always given me an underpinning grounding for understanding the way finance works and business works. But I also started working very early in my career in education, and I'm one of those very few people around the world that has a formalised education background in further and higher education, as well as business. But I also throw in some other things. So I studied medicine. I've worked extensively over 30 years in the resources and the health sector, so mining, oil and gas, medicine, health. And often people say to me, you know, what's the correlation and what's the commonality between those? Well, they're actually very common. You know, you might think that dealing with people and dealing with resources is different. The product is, but the process is very similar. There's a high risk involved. There's similar challenges and problems and so forth in business. What I realised is that both of them were very wasteful. They were not efficient. They don't work together. They're very fragmented. And about probably 10 years ago, I sort of made the statement, I believe business can be conducted differently. And I do. I think we need to look at the way that we work together in ecosystems and relationship-driven businesses. Instead of everybody trying to do everything, we should be actually working together harmoniously and saying, well, how do we hold hands and move together, move forward in one way? So in many ways, where the technology part, particularly the blockchain part, came in, I also recognised that businesses had been struggling to sometimes provide really good outcomes because they were hindered by compliance often. And so I was seeing businesses with outcomes that they hadn't planned. So what I wanted was a set of technology or some form of process that businesses could be supported and be efficient, operate better, be more cost efficient, have, you know, lower costs and higher profit margins so that they could employ more people, have a greater social impact and so forth. But underneath the bonnet, I wanted technology to stop them doing the wrong thing. And I wanted it to be seamless. When I said that, I had no idea 5 or 6 years ago I was talking about blockchain. Yeah. I had no idea that that was what I was talking about. And that's often the case when you have somebody like myself or other futurists and thought leaders. We're sometimes 10, 20 years ahead of the innovation curve. And that's sort of how I started to get into blockchain and technology and really aggressively look at how we can advance its potential, which is extraordinary.
It is, but in our rules-based society, do you think that technology is getting ahead of those that are in charge of making the rules and potentially increasing the risk landscape that's out there? Or do you think that it's inevitable that this is going to happen anyway, and what we need to do is try and find some way of getting those that are bringing in the regulation, the rules and all the rest, to try and catch up with the speed of technological transformation?
Oh, absolutely. Look, let's be really honest. There's some idiots running some countries in this world and uneducated ones. And I mean that in the sense that they're not educated in the future of work, the future of learning and technologies. I found it profound that right in the middle of coronavirus and the COVID-19 disaster, the UAE switched to completely digital channels for all its government services, for all its health worker credentials. It actually put into action its UPass, I think it's called UAE UPass, I think it was called. Right in the middle of that crisis. We've got other countries that have been implementing the same sorts of things, using the not only blockchain, but Internet of Things and other, you know, good data integrity programs and solutions and technologies. And we've got other countries, and Australia has to fall into that category, where the ignorance for digital transformation and the potential from digital technology have withheld and held us back and it set us up for being unprepared for where we sit. But I also do understand that there will be some people that will be struggling to keep up with that and will be left behind if we're not careful. And of course, that's where I advocate education. But we shouldn't be doing education in the middle of a crisis. This should have happened 6-10 years ago. And I've been banging my head against a brick wall, in some ways almost crucified, When I've suggested, you know, we needed digital skills, we should be, no learner should leave school without digital skills. Every business should have digital skills. Every individual should have digital skills. We should not have an elected decision maker that doesn't have the capacity to use digital skills.
It's frightening. You see so many kids going around with touchpad devices. You look at where in their education system they get this understanding of how electronic systems like that work, how cybersecurity comes into it, and you realize that there's actually nothing unless they do a specific course leading up to, in UK, GCSEs or A-levels that's focusing on computers or IT or design and technology. There's nothing in the formal curriculum that's giving everyone those basic skill sets, yet it's the one tool that everyone in society uses on a daily basis from the age of about 4.
And haven't we learned that in the last month? I presented to the APPG on blockchain in Westminster in June last year. And the three areas that I discussed, and it was the use of blockchain in education. And I use education very broadly, by the way, because education is only part of learning. And moving forward, we need to convert education to learning, not just education, because that's one of the challenges we have. But when I spoke about this, I spoke about three areas. The first thing I spoke about was the use of the technology in the business of education. So the organisations and the institutions who deliver learning, whoever they may be, and whether it be schools, further education, colleges, universities, workplaces, whoever that might be, how can we make those businesses more efficient so they can shift resources to provide more education to those who don't have it and can't afford it, and also in a more scalable way. The second part that I spoke about was the use of the technologies to change the way we educate. How do we deliver education in a different way where, for example, instead of funding at all, we start to talk about incentivizing learners to earn and learn, capturing their data so that they can actually have a different and a diversified base to move forward with their education, to capture their entire lifelong learning so we don't have entropy and we don't have their shoebox full of qualifications that can't be translated. That was the second area. The third area was, and I said, I actually stated this was the biggest area of opportunity, was education about technology. And that will not happen with teachers delivering that education. And this is where the ecosystem thinking comes in. We have amazing potential to capture the best in the world who, I'll give you an example. Adam Chayer is one of my colleagues who is the founder of Siri. Could you imagine the learners in school if they were being educated and hearing a podcast or a series on his development of how he was 20 years ahead of the curve and how he created Siri and what it meant and all of those sorts of things, how engaged they would be. If they had the person who developed the 3D printer who's printed the human heart, Eric from Cellink, to deliver that education. We need to be delivering to everyone the potential of this technology. How do we remote work? How do we use the technologies to engage? How do we engage globally? How do we do trade? All of those sorts of things. And we have fundamentally failed. And people like myself and other educationalists have been literally saying this constantly for 10 years. And in a very short period of time of 2 to 3 months, we now have this, catastrophic economic and health collapse in the globe. And everything is being attributed to COVID-19. And that's not true. It's our lack of preparedness for an event like this issue.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The thing I find absolutely fascinating is that in every national resilience threat assessment, the number one across the globe, the number one threat that there's been for at least the last 10 years has been an influenza type pandemic spreading across the world. In all the local resilience forums across the UK that the local councils work to, the number one threat for at least the last 10 years has been an influenza type pandemic spreading across the globe. And yet, when you look at the resilience planning that there's been in a lot of the NHS environments, and the NHS has actually responded pretty well to this, but in an awful lot of the businesses that are out there who should be listening to what's going on in the local resilience forums and looking at the threats and going, our contingency plans therefore need to be, haven't done any of it. They've used what I call the ostrich effect when they've looked at that and gone, oh, that'll never happen. Head in the sand, ass in the air. And that just leaves your nether regions very exposed. And people haven't looked at it and talked it through and embraced it. But do you think that this current pandemic... Sorry. I was going to say, do you think the current pandemic is forcing companies to completely rethink their strategies now? And we're going to see some technological and digital good out of this?
Yes and no. I'm going to go yes and no. I think there's a bit of a... I think there's a digital divide. I think in some ways the corporates, some of the corporates will ride this out if they had a very strong balance sheet and they had good digital capacity in some areas and they were fairly diversified in their workforce. But I think there's others that will fundamentally fail. I mean, you've only got to look at the big consulting companies, PwC, EY, KPMG, you know, et cetera, laying off, you know, 40, 50, 60% of their staff. I do not believe they will ever come back. Because the world has just discovered. I work very closely in the mining and resources sector still with a lot of colleagues in that space. The first thing they cut, the very first thing when the pandemic hit, and they were getting all the, you know, their bottom line and the shares and stuff started to drop, all contractors, all consulting gone. I don't think it'll ever come back. I think also those workforces that were resilient and able to be, you know, work from home and had businesses that had a diversified revenue base, I think they will recover. I think the ones that only had a singular focus are going to struggle, particularly the SME market is going to really, really struggle. And they had no need to. You know, I spoke at a presented in September, again, on an initiative that I started called Mind Shifting, a Tech Ed Accelerator. And it was specifically to work with the SME market and the frontier technology market and merge the two together to provide opportunities for SMEs, but not on an individual basis and looking at it from local enterprise partnership basis, from organisations that represented the mass numbers of small businesses to say, how can we make these businesses resilient? Now, I'm having this conversation in September last year, brought specialists in from all over the world to educate SMEs. And interestingly, the first session was to be in Southampton through Solent University in March. Obviously, you know, everything that went AWOL as a result. That's all gone. But the interesting thing about that is, we shouldn't have been doing that last year. We should have been doing that 5, 6 years ago. We should have had small businesses creating their own data footprint and diversifying and having a salient, you know, income from the sale of data, their own anonymized data. How do they make their businesses more resilient by having a diversified international and global outlook? And how do they educate their workforce? How do they bring innovators into an SME to build technology that's focused for an SME? And we haven't done it. And even up until 6 months ago, they're still looking at people like us saying it and going, oh, no, I don't really think that's relevant for us. Well, guess what? It is.
So are we now seeing Darwinian natural selection in businesses? It's those businesses that have been innovative, that have got that diversification capability, are the ones that are going to survive, and those that haven't are going to be the biggest victims of the COVID-19 disease.
I think it is. Yes, I think sadly so. I mean, I'm looking at some of the small to medium enterprises here within Australia and around the world, and had a lot to do with Europe in the last 4 or 5 days in that space. And even technology companies, and I'll give you an example. The global hack was on over the weekend. One of the most profound innovation experiences even I've experienced in my life. 15,000 participants globally, 1,000 teams registered, all over the world, 100 and something countries represented, completely done digitally. What I found extraordinary was the number of tech companies who were able to look at their technology and go, how can we use that platform in an innovative way to resolve other challenges and still keep doing our core business? And in a 48-hour period, they were able to pivot, completely turn around their business model and go, right, we can do this. I must say I was fairly chuffed that one of the companies that I mentored won their track on solidarity. And if I talk about that company in particular, and it directly affects the NHS, they currently run, it's called Booking Live, and they currently run the booking systems, if you like, for all the health services in behind the NHS and Allied Health. What they said was, how do we take that system and partner with other people and create and use the same system in an innovative way to get resources to the right people in the right place at the right time at the right price with transparency? That was profound. So those businesses who have that innovative mind and that diversity and ability to do that, I think will go from strength to strength. The businesses are going to struggle are those without any form of digital capacity who are still sitting at home with no idea on how to move forward. And that's actually through no fault of their own.
So if you could get the CEOs or the managing directors of those businesses that are sitting there at the moment going, what do we do? Following my ostrich effect method, and you wanted to shake them up, how would you shake them up? What would you be saying to them? And what are the lessons that you can pull out of that business that you said is very successful? What was it that gave them that ability to pivot within 48 hours that is something that potentially other businesses could pick up and run with?
Good point. That I look at the similarity in all of the teams that were there that won and will go to MVP. Definitely vision, definitely diversity, resilience, and education. They sit there knowing they're constantly in a vulnerable state. That's probably the best way to describe it. They might see themselves as being on the top of the market and very financially comfortable. They're cruising through growth. They've got a good niche in the market, but they don't see themselves as comfortable. They see themselves as of completely vulnerable and uncomfortable all the time. So they're forever seeking the next improvement and to diversify what they're doing so that if something happens, they can go here and they can shift that part of the business and move on. I mean, there was another extraordinary one where there was a fellow, happens to be an Australian, by the way, but living in Berlin, and they actually won the entire event called Suncrafter. And what they were doing were taking recycled solar panels and turning them into sanitizers for the health industry. Now, they won, it was extraordinary, and they'll go, so it was sustainable, the whole thing. Now, what was amazing about that was they weren't looking at the now. They were looking at in the future. They weren't going, oh, we can fix COVID-19 now. They're going, this is going to happen again. How do we do this in a sustainable way? How do we get this technology and these products and goods and services and offering into areas that may not have, the same things that we have in the UK, Australia or America or wherever? So I think it's also vision. Let's face it, we've all realised that the CEOs sitting at the top of some of these companies getting paid, extremely high salaries, aren't the most critical people in the economy. And they haven't been listening. They have not been listening. I think, what would I say to them? One of the things that I would say to them is get their backsides out of the office, and they should be participating in these innovation events. In fact, an aging innovation, it's the biggest aging innovation summit in the world in 2018. And I was asked to be part of a panel on innovation and aging. And at the end of the summit, the panel discussion, they asked You know, what's your takeaway? What's your thing you want to leave us with? And I said, don't come to an aged care conference. And they just looked at me and I said, go to a technology or a blockchain summit or conference. Get out of your comfort zone and go and learn what the potentials are and how people are using this, because it is extraordinary. And I did do that on the weekend during this global hack. I invited people from around the world, well and truly put them outside their comfort zone to see how innovation truly occurs. And they were just utterly blown away. That's what we need to take these CEOs to do. And also, more profoundly, how 15,000 people around the world could digitally engage.
Yeah.
And actively be engaged in a very impactful way.
Yeah. So that comes back to one of your skill sets in wider education. How do we then bring in, before we get out of this, because I think it's going to take quite a long time for us to properly get out of this, and whatever normality that comes is going to be different to the normality that there was beforehand. How do we educate those leaders of businesses that are sitting there today to be able to innovate better for tomorrow? Are the courses out there? Are the elements out there? Or is there going to be an awful lot more is going to come into the market to try and fill that? And then how do we motivate people to get in and participate?
Well, yes, I agree there is. And again, it's another initiative. It's quite funny, really. I've been involved in a project that is about creating a new form of a learning institution where learners can go. Best way to describe this is like a supermarket of skills. And it's about what are the capabilities that I require. And to underpin that is an education program that I've been involved in developing, which is, it's a different way of learning. But what it's about is showing by action-based learning how this technology will impact. So we don't actually ask them, you know, what does blockchain do, or what does the Internet of Things do, or what does Bitcoin mean, or whatever. We say, you actually have to go and do this task. You actually have to go and participate in a decentralized autonomous organization. And we're going to do a mission. And that mission is, you've got to do this and you've got to use this technology. So we're actually, I'm not prepared to wait for organic growth. That's the other thing. We can't wait for organic growth in this education. We have to actually pick and choose the elements of this that have the most impact, and we have to literally get people to use it to be able to understand it. So that exists. In fact, this is again an opportunity. So I see a lot of opportunity in where we're seeing now. China is an interesting one because we think that China is, you know, owns most of our manufacturing and a range of other things, and potentially it does. What the world owns on China is education. We've cut the borders to their education. They're absolutely craving education. So we're going back into China and delivering these skill sets into China. We should be doing the same into our own country. Yep. We've got a captive audience of people, of workforces sitting at home for the next, you know, 3 to 6 months. We should be delivering these scalable programs out. But I'm going to go into the challenges of that, is that most education is not prepared to do that. They're not even prepared to do that. That's the challenge we're facing. So, you know, it's people like me, and there's, you know, probably a handful, maybe 20 or 30 others around the world that have been working on this for 10 years. And we've been sitting on the peripherals because people think we're mad. You know, they think in many ways you really are crazy. And we're going, no, we're not. This is a new way of learning. And guess what? It's just hit. So, you know, I think we've got to focus. If anything, and we also need government drivers to and I don't mean to fund it, because I don't believe in funded education, but because I think it needs to demonstrate we're investing in our future and we're investing in something different. But I think for the first time, they need to start to listen to some of the thought leaders and the people that have been advocating this, and listen intently. And listening is not a very good skill for most governments. They like to waffle.
Well, exactly, and they don't realize that you've got two ears and one mouth, so you should be doing twice as much of this as you're doing with this.
Well, yes, and I think, you know, it leads me to, you know, you and I have had this discussion before in terms of, you know, the countries that have had the most powerful response to COVID-19, and the way they have engaged with their people, and they've all been women-led countries. What is different about that is in every single one of them, they've used technology. In every single one of them, they've used education. And every single one of them, they've used empathy and engagement. So, you know, I think there's a massive opportunity for those skill sets to be embedded in the way that we can encourage learners to come on board and see potential in this as well, if we look at those sort of leadership styles. But again, that's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, huge challenge. And do you think that your blockchain and technology is going to play an increasing part in getting us out of this, back into this new normality, whatever that is?
Oh, yeah. Look, some of the things that have and I look at this technology very differently. So anybody that knows me knows that I don't play in the cryptocurrency space. I look at the potentials of digital currencies, whether it be community currencies or cryptocurrencies. It's the digital transfer of value and the store of value and so forth. But I look at the number of new users. In the last month, we've had a 16% increase in the daily active use of wallets. We've had, if you're looking at just the decentralized, or DeFi as we call it, decentralized finance, we're looking at an 86% increase in the interaction with applications that are using decentralized finance. And this one is extraordinary, a 99% increase in the wallets interacting with exchanges. Wow. So, and I'm getting feedback saying there are new users. I'm seeing people saying, following the Twitter channels and things, saying, I've just bought my first Bitcoin. I've just bought my first Ethereum. It's fantastic. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think they're seeing a good, robust stability moving forward. But I also see that they're looking at an independence away from government-run decisions, that it's being market-run and so forth. And you know, a lot of the world that don't understand blockchain and distributed ledger and technologies and the way the currencies work, it's not fully it is regulated. There are controls, et cetera, and it's here to stay. But I think some of the other things that are going to drive it, without a doubt, data integrity, prediction and reporting. I mean, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out. We're getting rubbish data and we're going to get rubbish data out. We also can't verify it. So, and that can be anything from media reporting to health data to, you know, identity data. I think some of the other, you know, huge areas that there is actually some really collaborative work going on is in terms of your self-sovereign identity, in terms of capturing health information, vaccination information, proving whether I have or I haven't got antibodies. But it's not just about COVID. We're a global world. We should have that about our footprint of our health and our education should be something that I own and I can release and prove or not prove, so that instead of affecting everyone, we only affect the few that are affected. So I think it's a big conversation, but you know, it's not difficult. There's, as I said, UAE, you know, I've got a colleague that's working in the UAE that I'm working with as well on a big decentralized global trade platform.
Yep.
And he was telling me about, you know, this UAE Pass app. He said, it's amazing. He said, none of us, it's protected. They own their data. But he said, what it is, you go online, they were only told they could go out for certain things. They used to go online and get a digital pass. That digital pass was connected to their registration of their car. If they were found doing something that they were not supposed to do, that individual was challenged and sent home or fined or whatever, not a whole country.
Yep.
So, you know, we can really target those things if it's used appropriately. Supply chain is the other one. I mean, supply chain and transparency of supply chain is a massive improvement where, you know, we can for the first time look globally at where our supply chain's coming from. If people want to trade anonymously, they can. We can see where the goods and services are that we require. We can also diversify our markets. So there's a huge opportunity for this technology.
No, well, when you start to see the lawyers producing textbooks, I don't know whether that you can see that through the the virtual thing, looking at that, and blockchain and cryptocurrency, international legal and regulatory challenges, and it goes through all the different regulations that are in place at the moment across the globe, looking at it, and it's it is certainly something that governments haven't properly embraced and are changing the regulatory standards in the same way that technology seems to be advancing, which is in itself going to cause an issue. You know, in the UK itself, I was asked the Financial Conduct Authority, regulating all of the financial industries, what their approach to this textbook saying that anything using a public key blockchain could not be GDPR compliant and therefore could not be regulated properly under their current financial regulation rules. And they went away and for about 3 months thought about it and then came back to me and said, we take our lead from the Information Commissioner's office. And I got hold of the Information Commissioner's office and said, what are you doing about this to give some direction into the regulated industries? And they said, we're putting together a committee that will sit in 2020 and look at the impact of technologies on current and new regulations. And I said, but blockchain's in today. So what advice are you giving today? And they came back and said, we're putting a committee together to sit in 2020 to look at the impact. They were using my favorite ostrich effect, but it meant that there are a number of industries that are out there that are potentially exposed should something go wrong, and they then get taken to the courts because the rules and regulations are in place, but the methods of governing those and interpreting them and being able to apply modern technologies have not actually been looked at yet by the regulatory authorities. And that would, you know, the legal firm that's dealing with this is sitting there smiling, waiting for the first case to come through because they know it'll make them an awful lot of money, whether they're prosecuting or they're defending, it doesn't matter.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you think about most of the laws and the regulators that are governing most business are 200 years old. They haven't been updated to the technologies that we have now.
Well, unless they're you're United States of America, they're about 25 years old then.
Yeah, true. Sure. And they do a lot of stuff on the hop, obviously, especially.
Yeah, or whatever the president, whatever POTUS signed this morning as an executive order.
Yeah, and if you dare say anything different, they'll sack you. But I think, you know, here in, I can use the examples, you know, the UK, you know, obviously a lot of the Commonwealth countries that have taken on the archaic legislation that still sits, you know, in the framework that manages business and regulations, particularly around identities and so forth, they have not kept up to date with the capacities of technologies and what the actual technologies can do. I mean, you look at passport. I find passports, for example, is a prime example. We are a global economy, and yet we still carry around this book with a piece of paper in it that none of the systems are connected, and we could easily, within a month, if we wanted to, create a system where we all have an unowned identity, and we could use that identity, and we could release that information, and, you know, travel the world freely. But the problem we've got is the regulations don't match the technology and the two aren't coming together. And I also believe that this is also part of a fear factor. Because let's face it, let's be really honest, a lot of the people in government who are trying to control these regulations and to try and hold back and shackle the growth and the potential of these technologies are going to lose significant revenue. Some of them are going to be actually made defunct. You know, they're arguing about things that they shouldn't be arguing about. They don't even understand the difference between a permissionless and an open or a closed or what all the different sorts of blockchains and how it can work. And yet we have other nations, smaller nations, moving forward at a rapid pace. And I've got to tell you, they are going to be the country, you know, to watch. So, you know, I think some of the things they should be looking at, and, you know, it's an area that I know you know well, is, you know, cybersecurity and security in terms of, you know, we've now got every single person in the world digitally engaging. And, of course, You know, the first complaints we got is, oh, Zoom's to blame because Zoom didn't have great security. Well, actually, I disagree. Zoom had no idea that they were going to have an exponential increase in the number of people using their technologies. They've acted very quickly to try and put in security requirements. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But I don't think any technology is perfect that's going to stop all forms of cybersecurity. If somebody wants to crack into it, they're going to do that. But what we need is better education in what to look for and how to protect ourselves. How do we determine if we have been hacked? What do we do if we have been hacked? What do we do if somebody, you know, when we set up a Zoom meeting, those sorts of things. Instead of going for the blame game and then trying to say that all blockchain is bad or all, you know, video technology is bad and Zoom's terrible and Facebook's terrible, how about we look at what they have done for the world rather than what they haven't? Because could you imagine this situation now if we did not have these forms of technology, if we didn't have the Facebooks, the Instagrams, the Twitters, the videos.
Oh, it'd be shocking. The point that I put out, because I do some commentary on this fairly frequently into the mainstream press, and the thing I say is that what people don't understand is they don't understand their own digital exposure that's out there. You understand your physical exposure because you will only do things in your house when you've got the curtains closed and you've got the front door closed and you're in a room private by yourself and all the rest of it. But people will do exactly the same things when they're digitally exposed. And the biggest digital threat is that digit. And not understanding what that digit does whenever you're doing that, and who can see it, and what's happening out there, and whenever you hit send on something, the impact that has, whether it's someone being a troll on Twitter, or whether it's someone putting sensitive data out through unsecure platforms, which if that educated themselves a little bit with 30 seconds worth of even Google intelligence, they'd have found out that platform was insecure and they shouldn't be doing it. But people aren't doing that. They're just blindly assuming that because I've got this electronic box of wizardry in front of me, it's all going to sort itself out. Well, the biggest cybersecurity threat is the individual who's sitting there at the end and not understanding all of this. Not all these companies that are providing the technologies. Some are brilliant. Some are terrible. Most are adequate if used properly and if you've got all the right patches and everything else. And we saw that with the NotPetya and the WannaCry viruses that came out that exploited holes and gaps in patching in software that should have been patched years and years beforehand. If it had been, the damage wouldn't have been caused, but we saw the damage being caused. And it's fascinating. And it comes back to education again, I think.
Education is key. I mean, you know, I was amused in the US alone between when the COVID-19, the sort of, you know, the critical peak sort of started between about the 9th and about the 15th or 16th of March, there was increase just in the US alone of 50% in the use of VPN.
Yeah.
Now, I used that term. I was actually engaged in the last 2 weeks. One of our big emergency services here in Australia were told, like everybody else, you need to work remotely. You now need to go off and toddle off and you can no longer meet anymore and you need to run everything digitally. And they're going, and how do we do that? Fortunately, I happen to be here and I've spent, you know, 2 or 3 weeks with them trying to engage with them to work remotely and so forth. And I started using terms like VPN and they're going, what's that? They've got no idea. They're asking me questions like, what's my Apple ID? You know, do I have my password? How do I access my email? And when I'm talking, I'm just sitting there going, okay, don't be shocked by this because it's not their fault. You've got to try and educate them. But these are core capacities that we need to have. My parents who are 84 and 85, they'll have somebody ring up on the telephone. And there's been a big, you know, influx of those sorts of things coming in because, you know, there's a lot of false, you know, people trying to get information and there's people trying to sell your stuff and what have you. My mother very happily will hand out her name and address and date of birth to everybody that's dog, cat, and, you know, that rings up on the phone. And I'll go, Mum, don't tell them that. Don't tell them your business. Yeah, but they've asked me. I don't care. If they've rung you, ask them who they are. How have you verified who that individual is? Information. You know, it's yeah, it's a skill, you know. And again, it's the same with, we've all seen an explosion of the lack of veracity in information that's being forwarded around the world. And I'm to the point where I'm really rude and blunt now, because I'm actually getting some of this stuff that's being forwarded by, you know, professionals and educated people, professors and academics who are forwarding me stuff through WhatsApp. And I'm going, this is completely false. What have you done to verify that information? Oh, it came to me from somebody that I know. Yeah, but where did they get it from? Have you actually looked at where that information came from? Have you looked at, you know, who wrote it? Who authored it? Were the references? Was it true? Etc. And of course, what that's done, particularly in this circumstance, is it's sensationalized and catastrophized situations that should never have occurred. And that's a skill that we need to be teaching people: cybersecurity, veracity of information, making sure that it comes from a reliable source. How do you stop it coming? How do you stop it in its tracks, etc. I mean, I've got admiration for WhatsApp, for example, and they don't do everything perfectly. But let's face it, as soon as they realised the number of messages that were being forwarded, constantly forwarded, they put prohibition in on that forwarding capacity. Messages are still encrypted, but they recognise messages were being forwarded. Is it perfect? No. But the individual, as you said, is the responsible one.
Yeah, but see, again, this is nothing new. You know, Donald Trump's coined the phrase fake news, but fake news is nothing new. It's all deception in some way or other. And Sun Tzu in the 6th century, the great Chinese philosopher and general, turned around and said, all warfare is deception, all deception is warfare, in his book, The Art of War. It's something that's been taught at all of the military staff colleges for years, looking at the tactics of it, yet we seem to be constantly surprised about what's going on out there. The difference there is now is that it can be passed around very quickly, and something can reach senior decision makers directly through the power of social media. That's where the change is. But if we look back to the Second World War with Operation Fortitude, you know, the Allied forces were leading deceptive operations in convincing the Germans that we were going in through Pas-de-Calais, not through Normandy. And that included the Operation Mincemeat, where you're throwing dead bodies out of the back of aircraft, the top secret plans that were all completely false, having worked out where the information is going to get into the key decision makers. That's a very slow way of doing it. We can now just tweet them directly. But this is nothing new, and it constantly yeah. surprises me how educated people, as you say, fall for it all the time.
I know, and I that's what surprises me, and I'm not sure about the answers to this, other than further education of them, and because the mainstream person, if they get a message or a report that's come from a, you know, allegedly academic or professional person, they almost take that as being the veracious truth. And it's not. They've just forwarded it on. You know, I've hung up on a few people in conversations. I've gotten so angry because I'm hearing this misinformation. I just go, this is just nonsense. And I get really angry and, you know, hang up. And it's because I'm hearing nonsense, absolute and utter nonsense. From them. You know, what I'd like to be having conversations about is bring learned people in. Maybe this is a way of engaging them. Bring them in for some learned conversations to say, things like, okay, look at the data that we're receiving around the, you know, infection rates and deaths and all sorts of things when it comes to COVID. And I'm going to say again, garbage in, garbage out, because, you know, I'm having people who I'm directly having conversations with, who are at the coalface, who are involved, doctors, nurses, health professionals, and so forth. And I even said, what sort of correlation, this is one of the questions I asked, what correlation is there at the moment in the number of people who are getting severe infection reactions or signs and symptoms, who've had Fluvax and who've had Pneumovax? Yeah. What are the responses? Are they recovering? Are they being affected better or worse, et cetera? So in the future, we can look proactively at what we might be able to do. What are we doing in looking at, you know, I know we're saying that a lot of people who have in the high vulnerability rates have had, you know, a number of comorbidities. have they died from COVID-19 or have they died from the comorbidities and they just happen to have COVID-19 and we happen to put those statistics together? You know, we're not testing everybody. So the statistics are not pure. If you were running these statistics through an academic or professional program, they'd be picked a bit. They wouldn't even be allowed to go through. And yet we're making global decisions based on poor data that can't be verified. And that's where blockchain, by the way, can come in, because you can't misinterpret truth if you put the truth in the first place.
That's the key, getting the truth in the first place. Because if you get it slightly bit wrong at the beginning, it's going to amplify that error as you go further and further through the process. And therefore getting that purity of data and the mechanisms in place to have the purity of data as your baseline data is probably an even bigger challenge than we've got in dealing with this pandemic at the moment.
Yeah, and I think, again, we're not, are we learning lessons? I would say in many ways, no, because I'm starting to see this blame game now rather than, okay, none of us, and I don't think there's a person in the world who you could blame for the virus infecting the world. It's a virus, it's happened. Could we have done things differently and better? Absolutely. But nobody deliberately, or very few, I know there's obviously been some, but the majority of the world hasn't deliberately gone out with a vial of virus and said, here, I'm going to infect you all. What's happened is poor preparedness. And when it's happened is a lack of good quality data to tell us how things are responding. I mean, we've got countries like Switzerland doing their own thing. We've got UK doing one thing. Australia's doing another thing. New Zealand's doing another thing. Taiwan's doing another thing. Singapore's done another thing. America's doing nothing. So, if we are truly to change this, the globe needs to be looking at what are the global impact measures that we need to build, that the minute something like this ever happens again, and it will, that we activate the right questions globally and we all globally make some sound and solid decisions based on good quality data integrity.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that yet. I just don't think we're doing it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But I think on that point, for this particular podcast, that's a very good point to end on, because getting globally a global reaction to work better from a global perspective is something that gives us a start point for whenever we do the next one of these, if you're up for it.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Because I think business recovery and what the world's going to look like moving forward is such a huge potential, and it will look different. It will look very different. Yeah.
Well, Lisa, it's been a real pleasure talking to you on the With Ingram series of podcasts, and I look forward to doing the next one.
My pleasure, me too. Fantastic.